Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:21 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is December 23rd and it'll be my last day before the Christmas vacation and comment of the day and the subscribers video and audio will be back on Wednesday next week. I thought we'd kick off though with the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes by thinking about money supply because it's up a lot in the last 30 years, but it accelerated in no small manner in 2020. And I was looking at charts of, or at least various ratios this morning, and I thought that this one was particularly interesting. If we take the S&P 500 and then adjust it for money supply, then we're presented with a rather interesting chart. So we had strong organic growth in the 1990s, and we had then also a strong performance by the stock market, so that from about 1995 through to 2000, the S&P 500 did substantially better than money supply. So we had a very strong outperformance. In other words, there was more value being created in the stock market than was strictly influenced by the supply of money. Then we had a significant drawdown between 2000 and early 2009, and that was the result of two burst bubbles. So stocks fell more than money supply. In fact, it would be arguable to say, or at least I think reasonable to argue, that the decline in the S&P 500 would have been considerably worse were it not for the expansion of money supply. And now we can see that over the course of the last 2 months, this ratio has broken out to new 20-year highs. So the S&P 500 is going up faster than money supply. And I think that's important because we can look at the way that the ratio has been trading since the low in 2009. And I think we can break it into four very distinct periods. There was the pause in 2010-11, which was the withdrawal of the initial round of monetary accommodation. And then there was the kerfuffle around QE2 in 2015 and 16. And then we had the Trump tax cuts, but they were accompanied by tightening by the Federal Reserve, so they engaged in raising interest rates and tapering and then subsequently reducing the quantity of money outstanding, and that occurred in 2018. So then we had a rather lengthy period of nothing between 2018 and 19. Then we had the big drawdown at the end of 2018 and money supply started to increase again. And that helped stocks to appreciate, and they were on the cusp of breaking on the upside before the pandemic. And then, of course, we had the big surprise. And since then, we've had a really significant rebound. Now, if we're going to think about, well, where are we in the cycle? I think the pandemic is the beginning of a new cycle because it reset the monetary aggregates. And we're still now in a period of extraordinarily low interest rates, and we're still in a period where the Federal Reserve might be tapering, but they're not tightening. And we're certainly not in a fiscal austerity environment either. And there doesn't seem to be much prospect of that. Now, obviously, there are technicalities that will have to be addressed in 2022. One of those is that there will be another discussion about the Treasury and rebuilding its, war chest. So the U.S. Treasury is approaching the lower bounds in terms of how much money they have on deposit. So there's going to be a big tax haul, and they're going to start accumulating onto their balance sheet again, so that will withdraw some money from the markets. Then the Federal Reserve is going to further taper their assistance. So that will be less new money coming into the market. And then, of course, there is the question about whether they're serious about raising interest rates. They're certainly doing a lot of talking about it. And there's certainly a big argument about inflation. But the reality is that with some of the money starting to come out of the system, and with supply chains beginning to adjust, and the Baltic Dry Index is starting to come back down, well, those are going to mitigate some of the inflationary pressures. Then we can think about the fact that LNG cargoes are starting to migrate from the USA towards Europe. So UK natural gas prices came down with a bang in here today. They've been falling all day. And this is a whopping downward dynamic. So it suggests that we have a peak of at least near-term significance. And this hasn't been updated through today. So we've certainly seen a really significant drawdown coming through in here today. And what it's suggesting is that we're going to have a much more volatile trading environment for natural gas in Europe, because it was twinned today with news that weather might be a little bit warmer, so that would reduce demand. And then with increasing supply, we're seeing that some of the long positions were quickly unwound in here today. But we still have extraordinarily low reserves, so it means that any whiff of cold weather is going to result in additional volatility. So we're going to be in a much more choppy environment. But as long as prices aren't accelerating higher, well, there's the potential that we're going to have less to worry about. Then we've had quite a bit of volatility in agricultural commodities as well this week. And coffee prices had pulled back sharply earlier in the week and then began to rebound in here today, and or so yesterday. And they're so far holding the 220 cent level. So it's still a reasonably consistent advance overall. And the sugar price is also going to be one of the big determinants of inflationary pressures, because sugar goes into absolutely everything. Then we can think about the fact that that's also trending higher. But on a year-over-year basis, that will be the big determinant of how inflation is measured. And we had a lot of variability in commodity prices in 2020 and then again in 2021. Now, the one thing that I think is particularly important to pay attention to are raw industrial commodity prices. And they have surged higher, and they're at new all-time highs, and steadying again yesterday. So if this trend continues higher and it continues its surge, well, that's going to contribute to inflationary pressures. But then the other big question is going to be about the wealth effect. And when people feel better off, they tend to spend more. And when they spend more, then it creates more demand. And one of the primary reasons why we have these inflationary pressures is because of an increase in demand. So a lot of the reason for the wealth effect is because people have had more money from the government, but also because their pensions have done better, their stock portfolios have done better, their property values have increased, and their cryptocurrency balances have probably multiplied. So we're definitely seeing some inflationary pressures, but we've definitely seen a massive increase in the wealth effect as well. Now, obviously, some of the wealth effect is going to be justified and other parts of it aren't. And I've posted a rather interesting article today discussing the term bezel, and the best interpretation for it would be the wealth effect, how it increases during a bull market and decreases during a bear market. And it is obviously a product of both speculation and leverage. But One thing that we can then sort of draw that back to is to look at some of these charts, because the raw industrial commodity prices, well, they peaked in 2008, and then we had the brief blow off to a new high in 2011. But then realistically, it was the 2008 peak was the upper side of the range. And that was where we saw resistance coming in on multiple occasions in 2013, 14, and 18. So the price has now clearly broken on the upside, and it's completed a 15-year range. And that's a big deal, and it suggests that we're in a new price environment for commodities overall. And this is most particularly important for the industrial resources. So we can then look at the chart that we have here, and we also have the peak in 2007 in this occasion, and it was retested in 2011, and now we're back in the region of that peak, and it is looking increasingly likely that this range is going to be resolved on the upside and potentially within the next couple of weeks. And that would, I think, quite clearly begin to suggest that we're back in a secular bull market environment for industrial resources. Now, when we think about what were the really big sources of demand for commodities during the last commodity bull market, well, iron ore was one of the big ones. And iron ore prices are not making new highs. Now, we did have a really impressive rebound off the lows in 2020, and then it was completely given up. And the price back in 2008 was substantially higher than where it is today, although this future was only started in 2013 in Singapore. So iron ore isn't an easy, or it's not an easy commodity to monitor over the long term. So we might then think about looking at one of the major iron ore producers, because we get lots of back history. And from that perspective, Rio Tinto has reoriented. Rather than focusing on iron ore, they're now more focused on copper and aluminium. And they are positioning themselves as being the miner for the new economy. So if we're going to see industrial resources breaking on the upside, then we're going to need a new rationale. We're going to have a new narrative. Well, that's not difficult to come by. Back in the early 2000s, China entered the World Trade Organization, and they went on an epic building boom, and they were building new cities practically on a yearly basis, and it required epic quantities of industrial resources, and we had a massive investment boom to supply the Chinese demand. So now China is the majority consumer and processor of most of the industrial resources. Now, as we look towards the future, the narratives are twofold. The first is that there is going to be an energy transition. So one of I guess the two big commodity bull markets in the early 2000s were iron ore and oil. And there was an abiding view that the world was going to run out of oil. And what we in fact saw was that commodity bull markets are a reflection of the rising cost of marginal production. So as oil prices went up, what it in fact did was encourage new, more expensive oil into the market. So that was, I think, that brought to fruition unconventional oil and gas, particularly from the US shales, and that really started to come into the market in 2013 and 14, and the USA quickly became the biggest producer of oil and gas and one of the biggest exporters. So it turned the biggest importer into a significant exporter and completely upended the geopolitics of the energy sector at the same time. Now, oil prices are now in the region of the upper side of the range and holding the region of the trend mean, and we've had a really quite impressive rebound in here this week. So it suggests that we're still in an environment where supply is constrained and the global economy continues to recover. And we might think, and it was the way that we were thinking about the Delta variant a year ago, was that it was potentially going to be a Goldilocks scenario. That it was sufficiently scary to restrict the ability of governments and central banks to withdraw liquidity, but not so scary as to inhibit economic progress. And it's looking increasingly likely that the Omicron variant is similar, in that it is way more transmissible, but also less deadly. So, and I've seen comparisons with Omicron transmissibility being similar to that of measles. Well, if that's in the case, and it's upwards of 7 times more transmissible than the Delta variant, it means everyone's getting it. And then it's really only a question of just how much resistance does any individual have, whether it's from natural immunity or from vaccines or from a healthy lifestyle or whatever other factor, but we're all going to be exposed to it within the next few months. And the vast majority of people are going to experience little more than a cold-like scenario. So this is the potential that what we're looking at is the COVID pandemic devolving into little more than a bad flu. And that's potentially something that will be beneficial for markets because it will inhibit, at least at the beginning, central banks from withdrawing liquidity. And it should help to spur economic growth as people eventually encounter the virus on a personal basis, survive it, figure out that it wasn't that bad after all, and then just start getting on with their lives again. And with oil prices firming, I think it's also relevant that US natural gas prices were quite weak today, and down about 20 cents, and failing to push through the $4 area. So I think this is also important in that prices have been ranging below $6 for 12 years, and there hasn't been anything really to confirm that we're in a new secular bull market because there is ample supply. And in an ample supply environment, what you in fact get are new sources of demand. So we're starting to see new sources of demand coming through in the hydrogen market. And there's a lot of talk about building out infrastructure for blue hydrogen, for green hydrogen, and natural gas, I think, would be somewhere between brown and green hydrogen. And that's going to create new demand. And of course, we've seen a lot of new demand coming through for natural gas-fired power stations. And it's going to create an international market, because there's still this massive differential between US natural gas and European natural gas. So the big export facility in Louisiana, Cheniere Energy, continues to sustain the breakout from what was effectively a 7-year range, and it remains a bull market overall. And there's really no reason to believe that we're not going to have a globally fungible market for natural gas evolve over the coming years. So some of the tanker companies have been trending downwards for an awfully long time, but the evolution of an LNG globally fungible market should be beneficial for the sector overall. I still think, though, that it's likely we're going to see inflationary pressures moderating in 2022. And I think one way to think about it is that the stock market has already given us a perspective of what that might look like. And we can think about it from just simply how have stocks traded. Because in 2009, we had this huge rebound following an incredibly depressed environment. And back in 2020, it was the same thing. We had a crash lower, and at one point in March, 98% of shares were trading below their respective 200-day moving averages. And over the course of the year, we saw that almost everything rebounded. And we had this profound quantity of money thrown at the market. So once that ended, and we had this big rally, well, then you're going to get some reordering. There's going to be some sorting of the wheat from the chaff. And that's exactly what we've had over the course of the last 6 months. And this measure has contracted significantly, coming down from about 87% to 47%. And that's normal. And I suspect that that's an allegory for what we can anticipate from the stock market or from the broader economy, that we've had this surge in inflationary pressures. And they're going to moderate. I think the most important point is that they're unlikely to moderate to such an extent to obviate the risk from inflation. And we've had the inflationary surprises this year. And we're going to have an inflation moderation next year. And then it's quite likely that inflation will start to amp up again later. And that's what a trend looks like. Every trend starts with a breakout, a pullback, and then a higher high. And the Federal Reserve has said that they're waiting for an inflationary trend to evolve. And the ECB has demurred from any kind of tightening because they believe that these inflationary pressures are going to moderate and that it's going to, it would be presumptuous to withdraw liquidity and raise rates ahead of that event. And of course, they're also worried about internal growth in the Eurozone, and they don't want to do anything to weigh on the recovery, and not least because Europe is much more finely attuned to Chinese demand than the USA is. Europe exports as a percentage of the total economy considerably more to China than the US does. So when we then think about the outlook for European markets, well, the Euro Stoxx index has spent the last 6 months consolidating in the region of the upper side of what is effectively a 20-year base formation. So the big question for Europe is going to be, when will China take its foot off the neck of the Chinese property sector, and when will they get into the mold of expanding fiscal accommodation? And the Omicron variant may well be the catalyst, because we have a breakout of the Delta variant in Xi'an right now. And they've had 200 cases, and they've shut down the entire city, which has a population of about 12 or 13 million. And that's before the Omicron variant reaches China. So they've pretty much locked down the border with places like Myanmar and Cambodia, and they're trying their best to stop it from entering the country. But if it's as transmissible as measles, well, then that's going to be an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. And we also know that the Sinovac vaccines don't work. They weren't particularly effective versus the Delta variant, and they're even less effective versus the Omicron variant. And what that suggests is that the Chinese population is, just by sheer weight of numbers, is really at a significant risk. So if we start to see the Omicron variant starting to spread in China, it's going to be even more difficult for it to be contained. It's going to represent a bigger threat to economic growth and sentiment, and that is likely to be a catalyst for the Chinese government to ease up. And the real estate sector has been steadying, but what I think is also relevant to highlight is what's in some of these indices, because the CSI 300 real estate index is dominated by the state-owned developers, and it's at least steady. When we think about the Shanghai Property Index, and we can just look at those constituents, well, it certainly has the same kinds of constituents like PRE, but it has a lot more of the private companies. But importantly, it's actually doing better, and it has bounced from the lower side of its range. And we are starting to see that the CSI 300 itself has been firming, and its two largest constituents, which are Kweichow Muay Thai and Contemporary Amperex, which is CATL, the battery manufacturer, are both improving, and they represent about 10% of the index. And the index itself is beginning to firm here, and it's had a sequence of higher reaction lows over the course of the last 6 months. So it's been held back in many respects by the reluctance to boost fiscal accommodation, and it would be certainly benefited from both fiscal accommodation and some devaluation of the currency, because the renminbi has been among the strongest currencies in the world. It's appreciated versus just about everything this year. So then the continued appreciation of gold against even the renminbi, I think, is also relevant. So gold prices have been quite steady over the last few months, and there's a sequence of higher reaction lows for gold in renminbi. And when we think about some of the commodity-related currencies, it's been doing better. Some of the weaker currencies, it's been exploding on the upside and then pulling back violently as well, following the intervention to support the lira, for example. And then in Brazil, where the real has been reasonably steady over the course of the last year, it's also broken out. So gold is appreciating in the vast majority of currencies because, in many respects, I think it's a hedge against central banks making mistakes and also central banks being inhibited from doing what they need to. And in normal circumstances, with growth so strong and with asset prices doing so well, then it would be normal for central banks to restrict monetary accommodation. But because we're in a liquidity-fueled environment, then they're inhibited from doing anything untoward because of the risk that that would constitute for stocks. So coming back then to this question about the breath, which I started off the broadcast with. When we think about breath, then it's nice to think that central that there's a large number of shares are all doing well. And we've had a lot of angst being expressed in the market recently about breath, and a good part of the reason why people are expressing angst about breath is not just because of the historical precedent that at major market peaks, market breath tends to deteriorate and leadership funnels down into an increasingly small number of shares. And then ultimately, when those shares roll over, it takes the rest of the market with it. Well, we've definitely had the funneling of performance into a smaller number of shares. But I think what's also relevant is that the ARK Innovation ETF did spectacularly well in 2020. And it was sold on the basis of that these companies offer innovation and that they are going to be the next big thing. So with 1 year of really strong performance, these ETFs were added to a lot of portfolios in early 2021. And since early 2021, they've haven't quite halved, but it's not that far off it either. So we've had a really significant drawdown. And then when people look at their portfolios, well, they'll have to talk to their clients in January, and they'll be saying, "Yes, we invested in innovation, and we did exactly what we said we'd do. We invested in innovation, and unfortunately, it didn't do very well." And then the clients will be looking at their portfolios and saying, "Well, the stock market's up a lot." And when we think about the world equity indices and look at the just the year-to-date performance, the S&P 500 is up nearly 26%, and the ARK Innovation ETF is down about 35. So that's a massive divergence. And then obviously you have to have a rationale for that. So the rationale that's going to be related to investors and to clients in the first week of January, when all those meetings occur, are going to be that market breadth has deteriorated substantially, and that it's a really toppy signal, and that there's a note of caution that needs to be observed. And this kind of view has become practically the consensus over the course of the last couple of weeks. So there's certainly that. Then when we think about what the bullish one is, well, it's all focusing on the next new thing in innovation, which is the metaverse. And lots of people are talking about what Facebook has done. But I think that the most attractive of the metaverse prospects is Meituan. Now, Meituan did spectacularly well from 2018 through to the beginning of 2021, and it has also pulled back and more than halved. And it is certainly not immune from the volatility of the political environment inside China. But when we look at what the product offering is, well, they've been offering a sort of hybrid online physical product for years already, so that as you walk outside a place, you get alerts to tell you what kind of offers that restaurant or cafe has, and then if you engage, then you get points. If you write about what your product experience was while you're at the venue, then you get more points. And as you accumulate points and you accumulate clout and you accumulate followers on the app, well, then you suddenly find yourself in rather nice locations. And you find yourself being offered really attractive offers from companies. And suddenly you get to skip long lines because you're a more popular personality on the app, and you then start developing an online presence, and it becomes a virtuous circle. So the companies then get to have their products marketed to an active personality who is out and spending and interacting. And then they almost get free advertising, or it's a form of advertising from the actions of that person, and that encourages additional mobility. So the share peaked a year ago, and it is just beginning to find support now. And if this is the beginning of a new bull market, well, it will hold the low from from back in July and August. So Facebook is talking about virtual reality, and Microsoft is talking about augmented reality, and certainly Facebook needs something new to propel the share higher, because they've lost out on the last or on the most recent generation, and they haven't had the opportunity to take over TikTok. And TikTok is the social media app for the next generation. And some people are at least trying to sell the idea that Roblox is the app for the next youngest generation. And the share has been pulling back rather sharply over the course of the last month. So it's back now in the region of the 200-day moving average. I think, though, that if one company is going to try and emulate what Dianping has done, well, it's probably Yelp, because I've cer and sorry, I should make sure that that's back in the right currency. Yelp is now right in the region of the upper side of its base formation, and when we think about what do they do? Well, I've definitely found myself using the app more because they have implemented a queuing system. And it means that instead of queuing outside the more popular restaurants or the more popular brunch spots, you can simply queue from home. And it really does make it a lot more accessible. So that was a separate app that was developed probably 5 or 6 years ago, and Yelp appears to have simply copied it. And then you can pick up vouchers, and you can get discounts from restaurants, you can get benefits for writing reviews, and it's in many respects quite similar to the kind of environment that you have on Dianping, although without the whole social media aspect to it. But it is the kind of thing that would gel rather well with a metaverse type business model. And there's a well-developed base formation, so it would suggest that an upward catalyst could have a significant effect. And then, of course, if one wants to play it from the picks and shovels perspective, well, Unity software provides the kind of software that's being used in the production of virtual reality as well. So these are the kinds of sectors that could potentially do better next year, because there's an awful lot of interest in the metaverse. And if growth continues and breadth improves, and it would be reasonable to expect that breadth will improve, and not least because the Russell 2000 is starting to firm now from the lower side of its range. So we had the failed upside break, and it pulled back below the 200-day moving average, but now it's starting to steady again. So I think it's also worth just paying attention to the advanced decline line. So if we look at the advanced decline line for the S&P 500, then we have a really quite impressive trend. So it means that more shares are advancing than declining on a cumulative basis. And it's reasonable to assume that as long as this is trending higher, then we're not going to have a major top. We will have corrections along the way, there's no question of that, but we won't have a major top. But then let's look at the same measure for the Nasdaq. And when we look at the Nasdaq's chart, it looks completely different. And there are thousands of shares in the Nasdaq composite. So we've had a narrowing of breadth into the mega caps. But the advanced decline line for the Nasdaq peaked in the late 1990s, bottomed in 2009, and then has been mostly ranging, although with an upward bias since 2016. And I think it's quite likely that it's going to bottom soon if the Russell 2000 is also beginning to bottom, because that's a small cap index, and there's a lot of crossover between the constituents of the NASDAQ and the Russell 2000, because the NASDAQ composite is extraordinarily varied. And then we can think about the relative performance of the Fangman plus Tesla shares, because it broke out this week and we've had an orderly consolidation over the course of the last 2 months. So I was really enthused about the technology sector in November, and then it came straight back down. So I thought that was a bit of a warning, but then the shorts didn't work, and now we're starting to see the rebounds taking effect, and the relative performance of the largest companies is really quite impressive. So what this is also beginning to reflect is that economic growth is quite strong, and that we're still in a very liquid environment overall, and central banks are inhibited from raising rates, and bond yields are relatively well contained. So we're in something of a sweet spot. Now, if 10-year yields start trending through 2%, well, then that's going to be a warning signal in terms of liquidity, and particularly the kind of pressure that would come to bear on the US government because of the cost of servicing the debt. But all of the factors that would be relevant in terms of predicting a new bear market are not firing. So high yield spreads are not trending higher in a clear manner. Now, there's certainly a sequence of higher reaction lows, but the spread has contracted quite meaningfully over the course of the last couple of weeks. And then we don't have an inverted yield curve. Now, we've certainly seen that the yield curve spread has contracted meaningfully over the course of the last 6 months. And generally speaking, when we think about the peak that we had back in March, well, that suggests that we're going to have a shorter cycle on this occasion. In other words, this bull market is not going to last 11 years like we had with the last cycle, which was the longest cycle ever. But that doesn't mean it only has to last a year either. So it's quite likely that this measure is going to be volatile. We've had a meaningful contraction, particularly since October, and now the price, or I guess the spread, has been quite steady around the 80 basis point level. And investors, I think, are beginning to come around to the view that the Federal Reserve might say that they want to raise rates 3 times next year, or that the dot plot indicates that people think that that might occur, but that it's an unlikely scenario. So it's more likely that we're going to remain in a very liquid environment, and that financial conditions aren't going to get any easier, but they're not going to get tighter in a hurry either. And that's consistent with the second phase of a new cycle. So we're now out of the early stage of this bull market, and we're in the middle of it, in the middle stages, where financial liquidity starts to tighten, but from extraordinarily loose levels. And we're nowhere near yet the end of that process, where some of those measures start to express tightness. And we're seeing a great deal of enthusiasm and money flowing into speculative assets. So the size of the NFT market has swollen to about 7 billion, which on the scale of things is quite small. And Bitcoin is worth about 850 billion, and the rest of the cryptocurrency world is probably worth around the same. And the Bitcoin price is continuing to pause here around the $50,000 area. But over the course of the last 2 days, it has broken a short-term sequence of lower rally highs. And with the Nasdaq beginning to push back upwards and Tesla continuing to rebound, well, it suggests that we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. So Tesla has had a large upside weekly key reversal. That, of course, is dependent on it holding the advance tomorrow, but it had an upside key day reversal on what day is today? Thursday. On Tuesday, followed through on the upside yesterday, and then additionally followed through on the upside in here today. Tesla is an incredibly innovative company, and they've transformed the automotive sector, and they've been richly rewarded by investors. So that's all true. It has a valuation that assumes that the company will be manufacturing just about every car in the world within the decade. And the only possible way that could come to fruition is if they really are going to be the company that develops autonomous vehicles. Now, that's an awfully big promise, and it's certainly not an easy topic to bring to fruition. So, but at the moment, at least, the market is willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And Apple is now very close to a $3 trillion valuation, and the share is not yet rolling over. So it's still a steep uptrend and it's continuing to advance. If we want a read on how the consumer is doing, well then Amazon is certainly going to be a good way of thinking about that. Now, the kind of chart pattern that we have here is not the most encouraging. These lengthier ranges following explosive moves, they're not generally the most reliable continuation patterns, except for the fact that this is what Amazon does. And if we look at it on a logarithmic scale chart, and then we can see the ranges. So there have been plenty of times when Amazon has gone sideways for a year, or maybe even more than a year, and then it breaks on the upside. And the clearest consistency characteristic for the trend has been the ability of the share price to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Well, the 1,000-day moving average right now is in the region of the upper side of the underlying range, and in fact, it's above it. And that suggests that Amazon's price could fall $1,000 and it would still be in an area of potential support, and it would probably be an area where a lot of people would be buying it back. So, as long as it's holding the region of the 200-day moving average, I don't think anyone's going to be particularly worried, and nobody's experienced any kind of profit erosion yet. And the fact that the Fangman shares plus Tesla are breaking on the upside, well, that's going to renew confidence. And with Bitcoin starting to do better, that's going to renew confidence. And with the Russell 2000 starting to push back upwards again, well, then that's going to improve breadth. And those sorts of factors, that's likely to contribute to a renewal of this bull market environment. And it means that valuations are probably going to get even more aggressive. Because one thing that is particularly relevant is that the wealth effect and the valuations expansion that's possible, because we know that corporate profits and EPS are beginning to deteriorate. And this corporate profits chart hasn't been updated since September, so we're going to get another update for it. And of course, in September, it was for figures from June, so it's updated with a quarterly lag. But corporate profits, by all accounts, are beginning to moderate, which means that margin expansion is going to be the rationale for a lot of the advance that we see soon. And that's not a timing signal. Now, it tells us that valuations can then come back a lot whenever we have the next bull market, but there's no sign of a new bear market. So that suggests that this phenomenal bull market that began in 2009 and is still going is going to climax in bubbly valuations. And there are lots of people talking about bubbly valuations today. And that's all important because it's obvious. When you have companies trading on price to sales ratios in the teens, well, then that's an aggressive multiple. There's absolutely no question of that. But in order to have a meaningful pullback, we would need to see liquidity coming back and contracting in a significant fashion. And central banks kill off more bull markets than anything else. So it's unlikely that we're going to have a big surge in terms of oil prices. We could have a big surge in terms of copper prices. We could have a really big infrastructure-led growth cycle to replace oil as a transportation fuel and build a lot more generating capacity. And the wind sector has certainly been the favored sector in Europe, and the ETF is beginning to steady from the lower side of its range. And companies like Ørsted that are building some of these power stations and is also firming from the lower side of its range. Ultimately, there will have to be some form of backup power, and then small modular reactors are certainly in the running, and Rolls-Royce is picking up contracts on that front. So there's certainly a lot going on, and I think it can be broken down very much into two big market opportunities, because there's the infrastructure opportunity, and that twins with the energy transition, global warming, our control of emissions way of thinking. And then you have the innovation strategy. So innovation is very much centered right now on the metaverse and the next big thing. There was a tendency in 2020 to think that companies like Stratasys and the other 3D printers were on the cusp of a new revolution, and that might be just taking longer to evolve. And then, when we think about innovation, the one that's flying under the radar is biotech, because the ETFs are very heavily weighted by vaccine producers. But the innovation that's coming through as a result of genetic editing, genetic sequencing, and then increasingly synthetic biology, where the entire genome is written from scratch, this is incredible in terms of the technological potential. So It's a growth sector over the long term, but heavily influenced by attitudes towards vaccines in the short term, which would suggest that significant drawdowns are likely to be buying opportunities. When we think about the longer term, well, ultimately the debt mountains will have to be addressed, and the only possible way will be to devalue the purchasing power of currencies. So that's obviously one of the reasons why Bitcoin continues to do well, but it's also one of the primary reasons why gold continues to do well. And the price is pushing through the $1,800 area. And it has been like waiting for Godot, for a gold to surge on the upside. But it does look like this is just a large consolidation. And it's been really quite an orderly consolidation when we look at it on a 20-year basis. When we think about gold in terms of purchasing power parity, well, the price has been going sideways since the early 1980s, and it is now coming back towards the upper side of that range. And I still think that it is more likely than not that gold will break out in purchasing power parity terms, and that ETF holdings of gold will become the largest holdings anywhere. And the ETF holdings of gold are going to trend higher on a secular basis when gold prices start to push higher. They're already in the region of 100 million ounces, and that figure could increase substantially if gold can in fact push up and through and sustain a move above the $1,900 area. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend and wish everyone a Merry Christmas and a prosperous 2022. And I'll be back on Wednesday. Thank you.